Hello and welcome to the Modern Fairy Sightings podcast, where we listen to people's fairy encounters. But take heed, we're not talking about winged Tinkerbells here. These are real fairies, real encounters that took people like you and I by surprise. Stay a while and hear their stories. My name is Jo Hickey Hall, and I'm a folklore researcher. Dear listener, I hope you're well. It is a difficult time for the world right now, and we are all feeling grief and despair for people who are caught up in appalling warfare. Like many others, I cannot bear to watch the news right now, not only because of the heartbreaking images, but also the disgraceful division that is being sown among us brothers and sisters of this earth. I sincerely hope that we manage to band together and recognise that we are one, and rise above what only serves to separate us. As the old world and its previous power hold continues to crumble, grasping at us in its wake, we muster strength inside, linking our hearts with those who are suffering everywhere, and we envision the kind of world we are stepping into, free from greed, corruption, and division. May the love we hold for our fellow mortals and this planet conquer all. If you're feeling overwhelmed, some moments of self-care in the day can help. Yesterday, I took a walk in my local green space and found some sweet chestnuts which I brought home with me and roasted, and some berries grown by our local community. Just to make sure you ID properly, the spiky cases are sweet chestnuts and the harder, non-spiky ones are horse chestnuts, which are not edible but are great for crushing and washing clothes with. We're creeping ever closer to Samhain on 1st of November and Halloween on 31st of October. Traditionally the end of the year cycle, it definitely feels time to go inside, and I'm enjoying finding new meditations on Insight Timer app, which is free. I'm not paid to promote it, I just love it and tell everyone about it because it really helps to have a 5-minute meditation upon waking and then to listen to one as I go off to sleep. Going inside once a day really helps with managing anxiety about the external world at the moment. Don't forget there are things you can do in your local community and nature spots to help others, which will provide a sense of connection too. Let's build on that at the moment. In keeping with the season, this episode is rather unsettling. We hear of one woman's experiences with shadow people. One appears to be recognised as Anubis, the Egyptian protector god, while the other is a well-known archetype, the Hat Man, an entity who has appeared to many people and is traditionally seen as malevolent. Though the story shared in this episode provides another perspective. There is a trigger warning for those who might find it hard to listen to my guest describe her unhappy childhood, and the content itself is rather unnerving, so skip this one if you're sensitive to creepy content. In the exclusive bonus episode on Patreon, our guest describes a more recent, mind-blowing experience which was hugely transformative. Some kind of force poured through her body and took her directly to experience what I refer to as Source. Since that time, her life has taken a new direction. She finds herself in a long-lasting, happy relationship, pursuing what she feels was born to do, helping others. I want to thank my amazing supporters, the Curious Crew on Patreon, who have seen me through a really tricky year and continue to provide insight, warmth and community. Without their support, this project would simply not exist. I am thankful every day for their help. A special thanks goes to Kenneth, Muriel, Shelby and Nell in the Weird Folk tier. Welcome. We're meeting this month for a new offering which will be a monthly meditation. It feels like a good time to offer this to my community and I know how much it helps me. As always, we are also meeting for our Zoom chat, and this time it's on November the 1st, which is Samhain, to share spooky stories with each other, which I'm very much looking forward to. Do join us if you can support. And if not, please share the show with one other person and do subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen. I am also now offering 2 distant chakra healing appointments per week. So if you are interested in learning more about that, you can check out scarletofthefoe.com. At the end of the month, I'll be releasing a special Halloween-themed catch-up with Bethan Briggs-Miller and Ailsa Clark of Erie Essex, who will be sharing some haunting tales that they've collected from the public during their adventures out on the road this year. I've really enjoyed listening to some of these described on episodes of late on Erie Essex, so do check those out. We'll also be joined by Bethan's Spectre of the Sea co-host Owen Staton, also of Time Between Times podcast, for a suitably unsettling tale. Lastly, I just want to mention that I've had a lot of emails from people lately who tried contacting me on my contact form, which it seems is still not working. So if you have tried to write to me via the website, please email me at scarletofthefae@gmail.com. That's Scarlet with 2 T's and F-A-E. My new website is now nearing completion, so hopefully we won't have these issues going forward once that's finished. You can also contact me at @remain_curious on Instagram and Twitter. Enjoy the episode, and I'll see you at the end for a quick chat. Time to
okay, I guess it's probably easier to give some context in that I'd always seen quite unusual things and I was quite an unusual child. And I guess that goes right back to birth. I already came in quite unusual circumstances. My mum had been a very young girl when she fell pregnant. She'd been a bit of a naughty girl. She sort of dropped out of school, 14-year-old. She didn't like it. She decided that I'm not going anymore. So her and her best mate literally started truant in school with the hope to make it to the end of school, not get found out, go off, get jobs. Jobs are good, and face whatever consequence, or maybe just sneak in and do their exams, you know, make it look like they'd been at school. This was the mid-70s, so, you know, records weren't great. They weren't the truant officers like there is. There's no other systems that we've got now. So they basically got away with it, you know. And her and her best mate used to go and hang out where all the soldiers train. They used to go to the pubs, and say they were a little few more years older than what they were. And let's just cut long story short, mum got into trouble and didn't know what to do about it. She was absolutely terrified. She was just turned 15, really. She wasn't in a great place. This is the mid-70s. Those were different times for an unmarried mother, let alone an unmarried teen mother. Like any teenager, you know, we've all been there. She buried her head in the sand, kind of hoped it would go away, and decided to keep it a secret for as long as she could get away with it.
Oh, bless her. Yeah.
She must have been in this absolute fear, high anxiety state. You know, the parents were, my grandparents were typical of the time. They were latchkey kids, you know, the parents worked all day. They'd come home, there might be an evening meal together, potentially. Kids would do chores around the house, have a front door key, let themselves in after school. She had 2 older brothers. She was a mid-teenager anyway, so they didn't need supervision. So basically, roaming wild kids, and then parents would come home. They'd go out and socialise at night. Kids didn't need looking after. So, you know, they were pretty, standard 70s household, quite strict and, you know, not personable. And she was the youngest of 3, 2 older brothers. So she was just getting on with it, really, just being quite wild and sort of praising herself that she'd get away with it. And now she wasn't getting away with it. She was terrified, thinking that she'd be hired into an old naughty girls, schoolgirls home, you know, sent to a convent, a reform school. You know what these units were that where kids got sent in those days. And it was just terrifying. She didn't know what was going to happen to her. She was so busy sort of fixated on just trying to make it to the end of school without getting caught, because the fact she hadn't been for 2 years, she was kind of getting away with it nicely. And she was like, that was really the first goal, that she would be leaving school in May and she'd be 16. And I wasn't due till about June. She sort of calculated the best that she could. I was due beginning of June, end of June. That's the best she could come up with. But she didn't know for sure. She knew who the dad was, but she didn't know for sure. And nobody knew except for her best friend. So in the years of the kaftans and the clogs and the smock tops, she was able to get away with it. But she starved herself the whole time. She was starving herself. There was no prenatal care, and she just must have lived in this complete hypertense. So that, but then with pregnancy hormones, the two of us must have been in a real state. And I think she'd convinced herself that once school was over, she could go away with her best friend for a couple of weeks and do what needed to be done, whatever that was going to entail in the end. I don't think there was a happy ending in sight as far as the little baby me was. It was going to be a case of dumping it on an orphanage step or just something that would hide it, and she would get on with her life. She wasn't thinking straight, you know. She just turned 16. She was terrified. But I think that was pretty much the only two end goals that she could think of. She couldn't think of any other way out of it. She couldn't tell anyone. So I think my higher self or myself might have intervened at this section, because the time was ticking on and it was looking pretty grim. So I decided to come early. And I'm pretty sure that there was probably a reason behind that. I was probably dying. Mum was probably dying, potentially. There was obviously complications going on because of the state we were in. So I decided to come a little bit early. By about 8 to 10 weeks, we reckon. I was only 3 pounds born. Oh. She went into labour on the one night that everyone was in the house. Thankfully, where she couldn't hide it, really. She started having tummy troubles and complaining of tummy aches. And this went on for a few hours, from 9 o'clock till 1 o'clock. And it got to the point where she knew, even though it should have been impossible by her calculations, she was like, baby's definitely coming. All hell breaks loose. They have to get me to hospital. It's a touch and go. Just a couple of hours later, I'm here. I only weigh 3 pounds, whipped away to intensive care, put on support, and not given much hope for life, really. They warn my grandparents and my mum that things don't look great. And as you can imagine, the shock of that few hours has just sort of settled in. I can't imagine what the response were or how anyone was feeling at that time. But it was overtaken by this emergency and this tiny, tiny baba that needed all of this care. They kept having something called blue fits, which obviously meant that oxygen saturations were dropping. But quite miraculously, over the course of the next 8 weeks, I did get better. I started breathing on my own, even though I'd have these blue fits now and again and stopped breathing in my sleep. And then over the course of a year, it was like I was just a normal babber again.
Goodness me.
Quite miraculous given the circumstances. To cut a long story short, obviously it must have caused hell on earth at home for mum. And she was told to find a husband, but she wasn't booted out, which was the best outcome, really. So I went with my mum. We lived with the grandparents for a couple of years, and sort of true to our promise, she found a husband. She found another soldier who married her when I was two. My real dad, who didn't really know my existence until after I was born, waived all rights. He was kept a big secret. He's not even on my birth certificate. Just have a mum. I'm literally a legal immaculate conception. I've only got a mum. So yeah, it was a very unusual set of circumstances where I certainly wasn't planned for or wanted. It was just it happened and I arrived, and everyone was a bit panicked and mortified. So mum got married. But over the course of that couple of years, I've got really unique memories. So I can remember snapshots of my baby. So I remember my grandparents' house. I remember the feel of the playpen that I used to play in, this little net texture that I used to run my hands up and down. I can remember the picture on my cot. I can remember the smell of the creosote in the garden. I have all these really clear memories. And my mum will go, that's impossible. You're a baby. There's no way you remember that. And I didn't really grasp how unique that was amongst people. I've got four kids of my own. They don't remember anything in their childhood. So I do appreciate that the unusual circumstances potentially put me in close regions to death, maybe. I don't know. But I used to freak my mum out as a very small child. Our first married quarters, and we lived right next to a cemetery. And my mum didn't like it for that year that we lived. That was our first married quarter house with the new soldier husband. And I used to look out the window at the cemetery all the time, apparently, even though only two or three at the time. I would talk to the dead. My mum said I was obsessed with dead people, and I would talk to them all the time, just babbling away. And it freaked her out, so she asked for a move. So about a year later, we moved to a house directly opposite on the other side of the road that faced the house we were in. She just didn't like it. She said, you freaked me out. So we can go right the way back there and see if things were happening then. Might not necessarily remember who I was talking to then, but all the signs were already there. And I think the way that I came in may be an indication of where this came from. I don't know. It's something I give thought to, but that's the only explanation I've got.
Quite possibly.
Yeah. So maybe I lived in this sort of shadow world for the first year of my life. And then around about 4 or 5 years old, 4 year old, that's when we moved to Germany. And I think that's when it really gets pronounced, or certainly when the memories start forming better, maybe around those circumstances. But I used to lie in my room at night and I'd get these really weird sensations. Like the room would start breathing or growing, or I'd be sort of shrinking or growing. I could never quite work out which, but the whole room would suddenly change position on the axes of where it was. It would just get a bit blurry and bigger and more. I don't know, it was really hard to vocalize the sensations as a kid. All the textures would change. My breathing would get funny. I would start feeling quite fearful. And then I would start seeing energy and hearing tones in the room. It would be like, you know, when you blink your TV out at night back in the day, mm-hmm. And it would just go onto this white, fuzzy, white noise, basically, screen. It would be like that, but we'd be in the room, like all around us. I'd see lots of energy. And now and again, orbs would pop in, like little tiny pinprick orbs of light, which just cut through all of this noise. But when they came in, they would bring tones in my ears, really high-pitched tones. Some of them were a little bit lower. But most of the time, this one particular tone that was very distinct that would come in and cut through the noise. And it would really fill me with great anxiety. Yes, be like not understanding what was going on. But it was, you know, almost like a live simulation game. If you had like a virtual reality pair of glasses on, it's almost like you were playing some strange game, geometric shapes and all sorts. And then after that, I would see or hear murmuring, hearing voices, just sort of people murmuring around the room, as if I could hear people in another room next to me, but in the same room.
Yeah.
So that's when I started seeing more humanoid shapes. I think that's when the shadows, the silhouette people would pop into the room. And it was almost like I would just see them either walking past, like no interaction, or they would just be stood at the end of the room, almost like in the doorway would always be where it began, that kind of liminal space of a doorway, I guess. Mm-hmm. But that seemed to be, but then again, that would be also where it was sort of backlit, the light that would creak in from the hallway, I guess, around the corner of the door, might be the thing that was making them show up. I don't know, but it always felt like it started around the doorway.
Yeah.
And I would just see figures milling about. Sometimes it felt like they got really close to me, but most of the time it just felt like I was just getting a snapshot of something that was going on in that space, but not in my space. Like I was being overlaid on something else that was taking part in that same space at that same time, but not in our frequency, I guess, if that's the language I can use to describe it. And then the Anubis thing was a very similar way it started. I used to be awake quite late in the night because of these things that used to go on. I wouldn't even be in bed falling asleep. This isn't the imagination or somewhere between sleep and awake for a child, even though I was so young. Because of everything that used to go on, I was a really bad insomniac. So I'd be sitting looking at my clock on my wall. I had this teddy bear with eyes that went left and right with a pendulum that swung underneath it. Oh. I used to have to stop that quite often in the middle of the night. It got too much. Because you'd see the whites on each side of the eyes. He went left and right with the pendulum swinging. Just and my mum would come and start it again the next morning. She'd be like, oh, your clock stopped again. I was like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that happens. And it used to be me at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. I've had enough, I can't take it anymore. So I'd stop that. So I'd be very, very hyper awake. I wasn't anywhere near sleep. So this wasn't a sort of hypnagogic kind of experience at all. I'd be sat on top of my covers. Sometimes I'd need the toilet. And this particular night with the Anubis experience, I really needed the toilet and all this had taken place. And, you know, I can't even stand the feel of my own skin. Like I couldn't touch anything when I was in that kind of hyper state. It was very hyper aware, I guess, and hypersensitive to everything around me. But in amongst the shapes, my eyes went up and up and up to this really tall figure that was stood to the left-hand side of the room, looking out towards the shadows. And it seemed to be more shadows and silhouettes in my room that night than I'd ever seen before. It felt really busy compared to normal. It would only be a few, you know, 1, 2, sometimes 4 or 5. This felt like a boatload. It felt like loads of people seemed to be all of a sudden just in my room. And it was hard to tell whether they were looking at me or having anything to do with me or if I was just witnessing something again. Mm. But when I saw him, he was so different. He wasn't obviously the humanoid shape, almost up to the ceiling height wise. And yeah. as wide as he was tall, just about just huge, big muscular. You could see the definition in the black, because the normal shadow people, they'd almost be sort of blurry around the edges, you know, almost like a silhouette kind of, or a shadow that was being cast. Mm-hmm. Whereas this particular figure, this one night, bearing in mind I'm a 5-6-year-old girl, and I'd never seen an image of this before, and I've tried to rack my brain thinking if I've read Egyptian books. I'd read encyclopedias. I was an avid reader because I was a quite an isolated child in an army life. You don't make friends. You don't stay very long. So I read a lot, even as a wee child. Mm. But I would have recognised, I would have known the figure if I'd seen it before. So to me, this unknown huge thing in the corner of the room at the time was so terrifying. With the great big long nose and the jackal ears, very distinctive Anubis. I mean, if you've seen a picture of Anubis, you know exactly what I'm describing, because that's what I'm describing. And he was sort of just looking to the like across the side of the room, like almost towards the shadows, even though some of them were a little bit further forward. And I felt like there was like an exchange going on between them. I couldn't hear it. I wasn't privy to it, but it just felt like there was something going on, communication, the tension in the room, the atmosphere was electric. But I was just sat on my feet at the time, desperate to go to the toilet, desperate to run through to the hallway, to throw my bedroom door open and get the light on in full so that the light would come flooding into the room and chase all the shadows away, which is what I used to do. I used to pop my fingers into the sockets of my eyes and really push hard so I'd get all the colours popping out at me with my eyes shut. Lots of things to try and make these visions go away as a kid. Yeah. So I tried that, but I was sitting on top of my quilt, sitting on my feet, desperate, like tears were flowing from my eyes by that point, desperate to go to the toilet. But terrified to move. There was too many of them to run through. Like I would get brave now and again and just run through them, but like this night I just couldn't. There was no way I could move out of my bed. It just felt like I was stuck there for a good 10 minutes watching all this going on, and all of a sudden it's like he cocked his head to the right. I see the whole shape of the head cocks a little bit to the right. It was made of such black darkness I can't even begin to describe. Like it was made of the dark itself, darker than dark. So very distinctive from the others, and he sort of, it's almost like he'd sort of just noticed me, like, or noticed I could see him. Maybe that was it, that was the impression I got. It was almost like a cocky, oh hello, you appear to be able to see me. It was like you've noticed me noticing you. That's what felt happened. And he very slowly sort of turns his head towards the front, was facing me, sitting on my bed, and literally is looking at me straight. I mean, there's no eyes, there's no features. You know, I couldn't describe anything that he was wearing. But it's a very distinct shape. I could see the muscle definition. I could see the staff. He did have a staff in his hand that was as tall as he was, with the very distinct sort of flat end, not the hook staff, it was the one that's kind of flat. I don't know what that's called. But that's the staff he had in his hand. It was very distinct. I remember seeing it. Mm-hmm. And he'd had it in his hand and he was just stood so still for that whole 10 minutes until he sort of notices I've noticed him. And then he does. He looks straight at me, and that was, you know, my stomach nearly retched through my outside, like through my mouth at that point. My heart was thumping. And I just let go. I couldn't hold on anymore. That's like literally wet myself at that moment. It was just, I literally couldn't hold on anymore. I'd been stuck there for ages. And I think, I don't really remember how it, I think everything sort of fades out at that point when it just got so intense. And I needed to go, and I was quite upset with myself because I thought I'm going to get in trouble. I've just wet myself. I'm going to be in so much trouble now. And that, I just remember it kind of all fades out at that point. It just within moments of all that, it's almost as if it just blinks out, sort of fades out of my eyesight. And I was able to get up and run to the bathroom and sort of try and clean myself up and change the sheets in the middle of the night. So that was, I mean, mundane in itself. Nothing happened. Nothing terrifying happened. I mean, the whole thing that was terrifying about it was really my response. I was just a small child, but there was nothing threatening about the whole experience. I will say that I can look back and say that actually there was nothing going on that I should have been scared of. Yeah. It's just I was just a very small child who was scared, who didn't understand what was going on at all. But it was very real. It was as real as it comes. You know, it was stood there as real and as solid in his darkness, although the other guys, I could say, were slightly wispy and sort of translucent in their grayness and darkness. He was not at all, almost solid, yeah. I never saw him again from that. That's the only time I've ever seen him. But I did still occasionally see shadows and orbs and lights. But I often knew things. I found that I knew things as a kid. I wasn't like other kids. I didn't get on. I didn't really hang out with other kids. I was quite an isolated child anyway. But I often found I just knew what people were thinking, or I knew how people were feeling, or yeah. I'd say things even as a child that someone would say, well, I was literally just thinking that, like you've just plucked the words out of my head. And that carried on, and always having a knowingness. But other experiences that took place, like through my child, I would have, and that age as well, quite regularly at that age, I would have precog dreams, really mundane things, but things that you'd have a dream and a few days later it would happen, or it might even be a few years later. But precog dreams were quite a regular occurrence of my childhood. And I had what I thought was I didn't think at the time, but looking back, I thought was maybe a past life memory dream. So life, for as long as I could remember, I had a dream that was exactly the same in detail from the minute I had it as a baby to the last time I had it. So I always thought that might be a past life memory dream when I've looked back on it, where I run down some spiral staircase. It's like a stone, a castle, but it's going down into a cellar. And I get to the bottom of the cellar. I'm in a panic mode. I know I'm going to see someone down there who's hurt. They're in trouble. And I remember looking down as I'm running down the stairs. I get a snapshot of me. It's the only time I look down, but I can see me in that. I can see the bottom of a dress, and I can see the shoes, my feet in the shoes running. That's all I can see of me. So I do look down when I'm going down the stairs, so I'm able to see. Yeah. I'm definitely a woman, and clearly not poor. Clearly not poor. It's very fine wear that I'm wearing. The shoes are fine shoes. Mm-hmm. The bottom of the dress is showing really beautiful material. So I'm obviously well healed, literally. So I go down the stairs, and I'm aware that I know that I'm going to meet somebody. It's a man, and I think with adult eyes looking back, I might not have understood this as a child, but this is my lover, potentially. Mm. A secret lover that I shouldn't be with, or someone that I'm certainly affiliating with that I shouldn't be. That's definitely a given, because I'm panicked and I know that we've somehow been found out, and he's been hurt, or he's been found out, he's been hurt, something has gone on. So I'm racing down these stairs. I've been able to slip away briefly to see if he's there. And I get down to the bottom of the stairs, and it's not a huge room, but it's a cloistered room. They've got the arches and the cloisters in the ceiling. And then there's big wooden barrels, huge wooden barrels. It's about five or six of them dotted around this basement. And there's two or three lined together at the back. And behind them, there's this man that I've come to see, who is indeed injured. He's sort of bent over, pulled to the side. He's been shot. He's got blood coming from him. And I'm like, I look at him aghast, because obviously it's no longer just a rumour. It's not gossip anymore. It's real. He genuinely is hurt. And he reaches out for me. He's got blood on his hands. And I literally recoil back. And I went, I can't. They'll know, you know, if he's got his blood on me. If I go upstairs with blood on me, they're going to know that I've been to see him. So that, I think that's what I mean by that. I'm like, no, they'll know. They'll know we'll be caught. I've got to go. And I run away horrified and distressed. And I've got to get away. And I turn around and go run back up the stairs. And that's it. That's the snapshot of the dream. It's seconds long, but it was with me for my entire life, literally on a nightly basis, from as long as I can remember as a child, all the way till about, I think I was 18 or 19. And I'd already had my first child when that dream was the last time I ever had it. Yeah, it was with me all the time. The details never changed. They never really made a lot of sense to me. I always understood how I felt in the dream, but that's it. but it was just a snapshot that was with me forever.
That's so interesting. What's yeah. your relationship with that child?
The one...
you said that it stopped when you had...
Yeah, so I think maybe that's me becoming an adult. Maybe that closed that bridge down. I don't know. Maybe I've never really thought about the significance of the child. It was just, you know, that's my structure, I guess, changes because, you know, I'd had my first child. I was quite young. I don't know if that had any significance, and it changes the structure of your brain when you become a mother. And also you hit your early 20s. I hadn't hit my early 20s. Once you hit your early 20s, it reopens again at 22. It reboots into gear. That whole new structure sets up because you've gone through puberty and you've gone through growing up and all the rest of it, scientifically speaking.
I don't know, but just listening to that, it sounds as if there was this unfinished business and perhaps even regret of that moment, and that a part of you trying to rectify whatever happened in that relationship potentially, however it ended, and we don't know. I just wondered when you had your child, whether if you had a particularly close relationship with that child, you know, because we meet each other in different incarnations, don't we? We meet the same people. I mean, I've had regression before, and some people that played different roles in my other lives, if what I was seeing was correct, I don't know. But through those regression sessions, I recognize the people in the stories that I was looking at, that I was in, but I knew them in this life, and some people I recognized just because they were kind of on the periphery of my life, and some of them in the roles that I saw in previous lives were actually very close to me in this life and part of my family.
It's an interesting thing. I have often heard that we do keep coming back with the same soul family to play out all of the different scenarios and take turns in the different roles that you need to be for your soul growth and all that. I hadn't really thought about it in that context before, and I've never had a regression done. I would be interested in having a go to see. I did go once to a lady to see if she could help me go down that route, but it wasn't like a proper hypnotism session at all. It was sort of more like a meditation to try and help bring you down. I thought I got little snapshots, as almost as if I was flying through the sky looking down at a building that I thought could potentially house that spiral staircase, that structure that I'm running down. But that's as close as I got to it. I didn't really get anything else from it. So I would like to go to a professional hypnotist to see if that holds true at all, because I would be really intrigued to know what the rest of that story looks like. Like, it's almost like leaves you at a cliffhanger, go, well, who am I and who was he, and what happened next? Did he survive? Did we get caught? Do I get killed? Like, what? It just leaves you hanging. It's just a tiny little tidbit that lived with me forever. And I remember if I would see faces out and about that would remind me of him, so his face must have been really embellished on my brain. But certainly there were certainly other experiences that I've gone through. I think when I think about the blackness of Anubis, there's another experience that I had, which at first I was absolutely terrified and was convinced was the ghost of my house that I lived in, because it was very haunted, and we certainly had quite a few events in there that weren't just around me. Well, they would happen when I'm there, but there were witness events. It wasn't just me, so I didn't, you know, I wasn't always just imagining or conjuring anything. People would see major things that happened in that house. Like, I had an apport once where something just appears out of nowhere. That was a really interesting one. Neither here nor there as far as the object. I kind of wish I'd kept it, but the way that it appeared was witnessed by a couple of other people. So I was sitting in my bedroom and I was chatting to a friend. I had a big four-poster bed at the time, and just across the hallway in the living room was my partner, and he had the radio. We had the radio on in the living room as well, so I had the radio playing. And we're just chatting away, having a cigarette. And suddenly there was this really white burst of light, just a tiny, not tiny, maybe it was about the hand size, the size of my fist sort of size of white light that appeared right at the top of the headboard where the four-poster post went across. And out of it, something just dropped to the floor. And me and my friend both kind of stood there, well, sat there on the bed looking up and going, what on earth was that, you know? And we both sort of leaned over the edge of the bed to see what had just fell onto the floor. And there we find this little seed pod. And like I said, it was neither here nor there, but really unusual. Like, it wasn't just something just appearing out of a white light in the middle of a room.
Yeah.
But when that happened, at the very same time when my husband was in the living room, there was this huge a static burst that happened on the radio and interrupted like really loud. It, you know, nearly burst the speakers out. So my husband would be like, whoa, what's that? Like, the radio was just bursting my ears. And that's when we were like, oh, well, at the very, this is what happened. This is what you just heard. And showed him very excitedly a little tiny piece of seed shell that we were all very excited about. I do wish we kept hold of that.
Yes. So
that was a really unusual event. And then not long after that, I had this apparition in my room. And he reminded us of Anubis, I guess, in the sense of how big, the dimensions of him, how tall, how wide, how black he was. It was the same sort of material, or not material, certainly the same sort of black stuff that Anubis was made out of, and very similar in shape and size. My oldest daughter, again, had said that there was a man poking her in the belly and woke her up in the middle of the night. And that sort of, she'd said it a couple of times, and I was like, do you want to swap bedrooms? Because I never used to sort of say anything to them. I'd be very protective about them. I would sort of dismiss me, but not be dismissive. But at the same time, I'd listen, but never feed into it either. I was always so cautious about what I used to say and not want to scare anybody.
Yeah.
But sort of very aware of the things that I'd gone through, and just hoping that they didn't get the same kind of things that I used to, because it would terrify us. But I never used to have anybody to speak to. And I used to think, well, you know, as long as I don't make them feel crazy if they say anything, we'll act on it and make them feel better about it. I'd said, do you want to swap bedrooms? And Mummy can have your room for a little while, and you can share like the front room with my mother and daughter. So they agreed to share the first couple of nights. But on the third night, I remember waking up, and I had been asleep because I woke up. And don't normally, because I'm such a light sleeper and it takes us ages to get to sleep, I don't tend to sort of leave much of a dint in the bed. I'm always sort of just on it, just leaning on it, and I don't sink into the bed as such. I don't leave much of a body mark. I'm all over. I might sleep diagonal. I never sleep still for very long unless I'm totally asleep. So I know how light a sleeper I used to be. And when I woke up, I felt like my shoulders were really into the mattress, like really pressed deep. I never felt like being inside the mattress before. It was such an unusual feeling that it was distinctive. Definitely wasn't on top of the bed where I would normally wake up. But I didn't have that feeling of anything on my chest pressing down on me. So I didn't have that sensation at all, but I certainly felt like I was in the bed, like in deep into the mattress. And I looked at the end of the bed, sort of as my head pans up. And again, I wasn't paralyzed. I could move my head. And I noticed there was something darker at the end of my bed that moved. And as I followed sort of the darkness, this sort of form sort of come to my vision, and it was a great big tall man with the really long, flowing, old-fashioned overcoat, long, straggly hair that I could see, a really round, wide-brimmed hat, very old-fashioned, and just this huge man just looking at me. And I could feel myself being appraised. Actually, I could feel like my soul felt it was being looked into. That very same feeling with Anubis, I guess, that something that looks straight into you, straight at you, and sees you. It was a very similar feeling, which, you know, the Hat Man legend, which I definitely wasn't aware of at the time. And I thought that was the ghost of my house. I was like, oh, this is the ghost in the house that we hear. We'd seen things going up there, what looked like a white carrier bag going up the stairs. You'd hear someone's hand coming down or footsteps coming down one of the flights of stairs. Loads of people would witness things or hear things or feel things run past them. So that's what I thought I was seeing. I thought I was seeing maybe the ghost of this really deeply spiritual cleric type, very serious man. But I didn't ever feel threatened by him. In fact, I felt quite comfortable. In fairness, there was nothing threatening about this guy. And I'm obviously not that six-year-old little girl anymore. I'd had enough weird experiences, encounters, and loads of other strange things that had happened to us. So by that point, I was sort of a lot less afraid, certainly, of the bump things that went bump in the night. So I kind of looked it up and down and appraised it as well, thinking, well, actually, I don't feel anything bad from you. You're okay, actually. If you're kind of haunting the house, I'm okay with that, you know, because I thought I was looking at. Okay, and he just sort of faded away. That was it. He just went after this sort of 5 minute appraisal of each other. But I had my head up. I'd come up onto my elbows and looked straight at him. So I certainly wasn't in a state of paralysis. So I said I couldn't blame sleep paralysis. I went straight to sleep again after that, though. I did go straight back out again, which again was quite unusual in itself. But I certainly did feel like I know that I woke up, because I genuinely sat up. And I could feel the mattress. So, I'd had that same that same feeling with Anubis, but you know, years and years later, one of the few people I did speak about this kind of thing with, a friend of mine who has got, he's a huge history buff, he's very well learned, great guy, he told me, he was like, do you know that's an archetypal figure?
Yeah.
And I hadn't heard of that at the time, so that sort of led me onto a little bit of a rabbit hole as I looked into it and realized just how much of a whirlwind phenomena the Hat Man is, and how different he can appear to people, like different kind of hats. Some people see eyes, some people don't see eyes, some people feel terrified, sometimes he's got people with him. I didn't realize what such a global phenomena that was when I just thought it was my little ghost at my little house. So that really made me reevaluate that whole exchange, because I thought, well, what was that? If you weren't actually the ghost of the house, like, what on earth was I seeing? And so that was quite unusual.
Yeah, and another aspect of that same archetype is the dark man, as another aspect of that same type of archetype. I mean, that's something to look at as well. I mean, it sounds to me, I mean, I have so many questions, but it feels like you are very close to the other world, and you always have been, and whether this is to do with the very beginning of things when you came in and being so close to, you know, the other world and the potential that you may not make it, but you, like many other people, have remained close to the place from where we come, that other world, and that we return to all your life. And it's really interesting. I mean, both Anubis, as you know, or Anubis, I think the proper pronunciation is Anubis. I've always called him Anubis. You know, he was, of course, the jackal. The jackals in Egypt were well known for kind of roaming around the tomb areas and roaming around burial grounds, which is why the Egyptians ended up making these tombs, this one reason anyway, so that they couldn't be, you know, broken into by humans or jackals. So they were always associated with the other world. And of course, Anubis himself, from our understandings, was very much involved with, you know, measuring people's hearts, guiding people over to the other world, and preparing people for embalming process. And so your connection with growing up in that house as a young baby in the house that's next to the cemetery, you know, this is kind of his where he kicks about, isn't it? It's his cemeteries that you were clearly very comfortable with. And then, you know, he appears to you at the age of 5 or 6. And my immediate question would be, what was happening in your life around that age, 5 or 6? And also then when you saw this dark man, this Hat Man, what was happening around the age of 5 or 6 when you first saw him? Do you know?
Well, I mean, we talk about the protective influence. I probably needed protecting from even before being born, even directly from the plans that my mum potentially had for me as her way out, I guess. Of course, I did have the blue fits, but I did occasionally, even grown as an adult, and even as recent as last year, I would still have moments where I would stop breathing in my sleep, so that, you know, I was always had that sort of health thing that may explain it, which I kind of had to give a lot of thought to, because there is another experience which I'll come back to that made me think about all of that, which is what made me sort of connect the death connection, maybe going back to childhood, that they're all connected in some way. But I'll come back to that one. So I guess I didn't have, you know, this wasn't like, oh, baby came along, she was tiny, she was helpless, everyone fell in love, yay, everyone had a happy life after that. It was very much not the case at all. It was tense. The grandparents were obviously quite upset and disappointed and ashamed. Find a husband, you know, that was very much a command, find a husband. Can you imagine telling your child, find a husband? Like, I would never dream of saying that now, but this was the 70s and these were the times. And she did, she found a husband, but latching on to the first guy that you meet, you know, when people meet people and then get married straight away, you're marrying a stranger, aren't you? You don't know who you're marrying. It's crazy. I think it's the very definition of mental illness when people get with strangers, and then a couple of years down the line after having these whirlwind romances of moving in and getting married in 6 weeks, and then 3 years down the line they'll go, but they've changed. The army's it's a difficult life. It's a contained, it's an isolated unit. You're either in the army or you're not in the army. It's that kind of unit, in it.
And when you're
an army wife and child, you go around all these estates, and that's where your life is based. And then, you know, 1 week to the next, you could be getting a posting, or the people around you are getting posting all the time. So there's no stability, there's no stable ground, there's no shelter, there's no protection. You are literally, you know, out there on your own. And once mum had left home, the grandparents, you know, moved. They moved straight away from the area where we lived. And at that time, they moved to the sort of other side of the country. A beautiful move. Like, I love that they went where they went, because that's where a great deal of my childhood visits took place. It became a favourite place of mine. But, you know, with adult eyes, I can look back and go, that clearly indicated a move away from where they were from. And that's, you know, obviously wasn't any coincidence that they got as far away as they could get and started all over again. And that was it. There'd be letters and there'd be phone calls, but there was nobody coming out to the overseas postings to see my mum. She had very little contact. She was out there on her own, and, you know, she sort of made that bed that she was always going to have to lie in, unfortunately. And their first husband wasn't a particularly nice man, so it wasn't a happy marriage, and it certainly wasn't a happy household. There was some untoward stuff that went on. So it wasn't a great place, and I was very isolated, and I was having these major experiences. And it may be, sort of giving it a thought as an adult looking back, maybe that was protection that was all around me. Maybe I was having, you know, and I've always been looked after. There's always been something that's always looked after my whole life. I always seem to get gifts from the universe from time to time. That's for sure. And I often find myself in the right time, in the right place for certain people. I've always been there to help people when they've needed it in the most unusual of circumstances. So I always feel like I've had this little mission that I've been carried on ever since it. Once you sort of become aware of it, you know things. You know how, I know how other people are feeling, and I can see through other people. People can't lie to me. They're not very good.
Yeah.
If they're liars or if they're fake people, they don't tend to like me, can't be around me for very long. They tend to make their excuses. They can't even look me in the eye. So there's a lot of the time I didn't fit in many places at all, because somewhere along the line we're all faking it to make it somewhere to fit in, you know. But yeah, I'm not very good at doing that. So I tended to find myself on my own quite a lot. And you didn't make friends as a child. You didn't get roots. You didn't really feel wanted anywhere. And you know, as a child, my mum had very little to do with me. We didn't have any sort of fun times particularly. I don't remember too many family occasions. It was all sort of still post-traumatic from everything that had gone on, I guess.
She must have been massively traumatised.
It wasn't the way that she hoped that it was going to end. It wasn't what she wanted to happen in the first place. So when we moved back to England, she met somebody else who was a lovely guy, and she ran away with him, and we came, that's how we ended up in the northeast. So we kind of we absconded in the middle of the night and got away from that, left all that behind us, so that you'd think, you know, she'd be able to start to heal and get past it with the love of a really nice man who was the complete opposite of what she had just come from. And maybe she might be able to start, make some roots. And so we moved up here. And unfortunately, while my mum healed, that also gave her that opportunity to break, because for the first time since being that pregnant 15-year-old girl, that fight or flight response was no longer necessary. That's when she broke, unfortunately. So had a massive mental breakdown. These are not happy times. All of those events had such serious knock-on consequences in the end.
So sad. I mean, it kind of really stems from societal expectations, doesn't it? You know, the way that she wasn't able. I mean, the most natural thing in the world is for a woman to have a baby.
That's
effectively how this earth works. It's so bizarre how people get so tied up in knots about the fact that a woman will have a baby. It's just beyond me. And this earth is such a strange place, isn't it, with people behaving so strangely. So it's no wonder that, you know, there's an aspect with many of us, do I really want to be here, actually? Do I want to come into this world or not? You know, and it's touch and go. You're looking at the consciousness of the person. Is this somewhere that I really want to be? And, you know, luckily you did decide to stay here and have been able to have, you know, some beautiful children yourself and have your own life. But you can really feel that if you raise up and look at the situation from all the different points of view, as a soul incarnating into this world and what is going on in those moments of whether they want to be here or not. And it sounds like at a deep place, even though it wasn't perhaps apparent to you, there was love there from somewhere. And her parents were obviously just really mixed up and more worried about what people will say. And so, you know, they've created this really ridiculous situation. It's I feel so sorry, you know, to hear your story and how difficult that would have been for this little being to come in to this world. But you know, you came, sounds like you came for a really good reason. And I wonder if, you know, this kind of line that you tread between the worlds, it seems that you're very familiar. I don't know if you had a sense of familiarity when you saw the dark man as well, but I also wonder whether what you do with your life now, is it something to do with helping people that are also between worlds, so for instance in kind of medical care or some other kind of situation where you're able to impart something between the worlds from the other world to the earth. Do you play a role like that with your life at the moment?
I did for quite some time, actually, which kind of, I guess, segues nicely onto the big transformative experience, because it was after that I made the move that I did.
This section is available for all members of the Curious Crew who support me on Patreon. Join us there for this and more bonus content. patreon.com/the Modern Fairy Sightings Podcast.
As a child, I'm aware that obviously when Anubis appeared, and you said you were about 5 or 6 at the time, and you were living in an army community at the time, weren't you?
Yeah.
So again, it's kind of as close to death, isn't it? Because these guys are, they're preparing for war. They may have, I don't know whether there was any kind of combat at the time when you were 5 or 6, so I don't know what year it was, but when you had the Anubis experience, could it be connected in with when your mum's husband, your father at the time, would have been going away to war, or did that not quite fit in with that timeline?
I don't know, because I don't know. Potentially, he wasn't. There were plenty of times where we'd have a few months where he wasn't around because he'd be away.
Yeah.
And there were tours that were done in Northern Ireland. The Falklands was going on. It was the very early 80s. A few conflicts going on. There was probably some conflicts, and those nights, in particular that night when there was a lot of people seemed to be crossing over, it definitely felt like that.
Well,
that
that's been
a big event. Something definitely happened for that many. I couldn't imagine that many entities come to visit me. That didn't ever feel like that's what that was. It didn't feel like a personal exchange, but maybe it was. It was, you know, I'm 6 and it's quite hard to read. And when you're just fearful rather than facing the situation, sort of interacting with it, which I might have done later on in life. But as a child, you're kind of just backing away from it because you don't understand it. But yeah, that felt like there must have been some sort of big event that had happened for so many to people, because it was such a busy night compared to normal. And the fact that he was there when he wouldn't normally be there, it's not something you'd see every night. So that suggests that something special had happened that night, or something extreme had happened that night.
Had you ever tried to date it in terms, you know, vaguely by the kind of season and the year, and whether anything would have happened around that time, or even the history of the army estate?
There's nothing about that estate that I don't remember, even though I was so young. But I'm not aware of any history. Mm. I was nearly struck by lightning the very first day I arrived there. When I was 5, we'd flown over, and the big BFBO boxes had been delivered, these huge big crates with all your belongings in. Mm. And I was just lying on the grass. So you'd have a big patch of square grass between each block of flats set out on this oval, in the middle section. Flying on the ground, looking at this beautiful blue clear sky, not a cloud in sight anywhere. And it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I want to say that was springtime, when I think it was about April or May, the lightning literally came out of a clear blue cobalt sky and hit the tree, which was right next to where I was laying, looking up at the tree, basically underneath the tree, a little bit to the side of it. And my mum came running out onto the balcony, screaming, basically, get in the house, get in the house. And then the rain came from nowhere. So this beautiful, gorgeous day literally turned in an instant, and I learned what European storms look like. They're extreme. But about a year after that, maybe almost exactly a year, I think, and I don't know if he's around just after this time, but the experiences were already happening. That had been happening since I'd first moved out there, where you were seeing these shadows or having these odd energetic experiences or these weird feelings and these senses attacks, you know. So the tones and that, they'd been happening the whole time I was there, and I'm pretty sure they used to happen before I went out there. I'm pretty sure that was something that went right back as far as I could remember. But him being there, I definitely think it would be after the second lightning strike. So the year later, I'm sitting on my bedroom floor and I'm just playing on the floor with whatever, with books and toys and Barbies, and had an action man and a big tank and everything. Because of course I did. I was surrounded by the army, so the boys would buy me stuff. And I was a bit of a tomboy as well. So I was sat on the floor and I was just looking up at my windowsill, looking at the storm outside, because I was obviously quite fascinated with lightning and storms. And I looked, and the lightning came towards me again. It came directly towards my window, but it happened in real slow motion, like a strobe light. So it was like a flash, 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 and about three or four flashes later, my window cracks. I'd obviously seen the lightning coming straight at me, milliseconds, you know, but I saw that lightning coming straight at my window, hit the window, crack the window, and then Fritz, my little doll thing, it melted it. There was a little bit of it sparked, and there was a little bit of scorch mark on it. So that pretty much stopped me from getting struck that day. So lightning definitely has a thing for me. When I was in Germany, yeah, I came close to it again. It's mad. And then there is another time, much later in life actually, where I came close to getting struck a third time, where it was just outside. I've got a balcony again, and I was watching this thunderstorm one Sunday night, fabulous thunderstorm. So I'm sort of sitting on my balcony, feet hanging out on the balcony, half in, because I was watching, if you remember, Alfida Zempet had a new series that on the TV for a little while. So with me and a couple of friends were here. The lightning came again. So the lightning literally struck the road right in front of my driveway at the end of my garden, like my front yard path. And it was so close, it was so bright, it lit up the whole room. And me and the lad that was stood next to us, all our hairs literally stood up on end on my arms and on my head. So that one came close. And I hadn't thought about that before, but that's probably not long before the transformative experience, which, you know, now that I've got different language with all the research and the sort of the internet existing the way it does now, I've got better language for it. But back then I used to call it a bloodless stigmata, because that's the only language I could assign to it, because it was the hands and it was the palms and it was the head. But having seen other people's experiences, I think they call it potentially either a near-death experience or a spiritually transformative experience. I don't know which one it falls under. Like,
yeah, you've been having these experiences, you know, all your life by the sound of it, and it is quite amazing. I mean, I don't know much about the Dark Man. Dara Mason from Spirit Box podcast is about to release a book, I believe, this year about the Dark Man. So when that comes out, I would urge you to look into that, because you know, there is this figure that does appear in folklore, but also in people's experiences, where, you know, and they are sometimes kind of tied in with the Hat Man as well, because that can also be this dark figure that appears, and they always do seem to mark these moments of transition or some kind of prophetic sort of warning or connection through to the other world in some way, or they might trigger somebody to begin working in ritual or around the time where they're placed on some kind of life path. And it sounds like you met with source, and it's just really fascinating to talk to you. Yeah, I just wonder kind of whether you will end up working in some way sort of directly with these forces, because it sounds like they've always wanted to come through. And it was so interesting. Thank you so much for sharing these stories with me. I really do find it fascinating. You know, it's people's personal preference whether they go to regression, because of course, you know, you never know, do you? You never know what's going to come out of these sessions. So, but if you ever did, it would be really interesting to know what comes up for you. When you had the Anubis experience in your bedroom, do you remember kind of what time of year it was? And did you feel like the people that were, or the beings that were present in the room, did you feel like that was kind of present, or whether it was past or future? Did you get a sense of that at all?
It felt like present. It felt like I was in the present, that whatever was happening to them, not so much to me. It didn't feel like they were coming at me to communicate with me or involve me. I certainly never felt that way, but I might not have understood because I was so young that maybe they were trying, but I didn't know how to tune in. I was so busy trying to get away from them. And I think that was a theme probably for the first 20 odd, all of these mad experiences that were having, because I didn't understand them and I couldn't explain them. And if you tried to talk to people about them, they would just look at you like you were a little bit mental. You probably needed some medical help because of all the experience that you've had. So it's left you a bit unstable.
Some
of the reactions that you'd get from it, or it would go the other way around, that if you tried to say that you had any sort of psychic abilities, they would test you straight away. What does my uncle Bill, have you got any messages? Or they'd want you to sort of perform on the spot.
Yeah.
And if you couldn't, it doesn't work like that as far as I'm concerned. I don't think you can, maybe you can, maybe you can't, maybe you can do training, but I was always so fearful of it and didn't understand it as a kid that I didn't. I always looked for the most, I did go to a spiritualist church a few times and I got to know this lovely guy at one of our local spiritualist church, and he invited me to come along, and he said that I could see that he could see this exceptionally large aura and this exceptionally open stage. And I was like, yeah, no kidding, like that's exactly why I'm here, like how do I make that stop, you know? And he was like, well, most people come to me to develop. And I was like, I don't want to develop, I want to be able to switch it on and off, you know. If I want to work with it, I want it to be on my terms. And unless somebody can sort of give me that kind of level of control, because it never feels like I'm in control. And he didn't really know what to say to that. Just talked about how to give myself protection. And because I hadn't had that necessarily had that transformative experience yet, and I was quite anti-God, and he was using a lot of godly and spiritual and religious it just didn't feel like it fit with me.
Right.
I wasn't really prepared to keep going back. I didn't want to say prayers at the beginning. It was just I was so, between the grief of losing the grandparents, who I did love dearly, as a kid, like for everything that we've been through, I never got to see any of that because I grew up with these grandparents that would host me every summer and treat me like a child, and it would be lovely. I'd be looked after and felt loved and warm and safe. So when they died, and I hadn't really been aware too much of the full history of everything that had happened, I was really cut loose, I guess. And I think that chaotic energy, that chaotic depression and craziness and anger and frustration within me probably didn't help me settle those energies properly and integrate them, maybe, or give them the attention that they deserved, I guess. I think maybe there was a lot of gifts on my plate that I didn't know how to use, and I was frightened of, because I was frightened of life, I guess. And,
of course, because it had been a difficult place for you. And, you know, that whole thing about, well, you're either mad and, you know, should be locked up, or you're a spectacle, entertain us.
Yeah.
You know,
and you're obviously lying. If you can't put me on the spot and tell me where Uncle Bill hid the will, you know, then you're obviously just full of it, and it just sort of degrades you, and it just... It means that I never used to speak about this to a lot of people at all, unless people were really interested and had shared similar experiences. Mm-hmm. But even then, like, there's only so many, like, people seeing a little bit of a ghost in the house. It's not this, you know, if you've got so many stories like I have and so many experiences somewhere along the line, people go, nah, that's too many. You're just making it up now. You're just, you've had that different kind of experience and that different. They just think that you're paying them for attention or just jumping in on anything. And I genuinely wasn't. And a lot of this was witnessed, you know. I wasn't always on my own when stuff like this happened. So you just learn to clam up. You didn't want to talk about it. I did go and get some Reiki training, though, later on in life. I think, again, after the transformative experience, I went into that care.
Yeah, I was wondering if you might want to take up healing or something, because it sounds...
I always, yeah.
the energy was flowing.
The one thing that did come back with me from that experience is knowing I could heal, knowing that I was very good with people, and that I was very good at reaching in and touching people's souls. And that became part of the project for the lovely bistro that I ran. It became about it being a healing space, a safe space, that I always put that magic into the cooking and the things that I made. But people would often come and I would sort of, you know, I had to advertise because it was invisible. It was like this basement that you didn't know was there. There's no door, there's no nothing. So you had to really try and get, not like a gimmick, but certainly make people feel like they wanted to come back again if they did find it like this special place. And quite often they'd come down and it would just be me down there. So I'd be sitting having lovely conversations with these complete strangers. I would take food out, anything that was always left over. There was never anything that went in the bin. If I had leftover cake that wasn't used and it was going to go out a day, everything went out to the homeless on the streets. I used to have a collection jar so people could pay it forward. And as soon as there was a few quid in that jar, all of the leftovers, all of the soups would be defrosted and the whole street would be fed because there was a lot of homeless on that street. And people would come down and out of nowhere, like as has been a skill my entire life, people would tell me the life stories, they would open up, they would share. People would always feel very safe and very held in my presence. And that was something I always knew that I was good at. I even little chance encounters in cafes in Amsterdam while I was waiting for some friends to go back to the hotel to get some bits and bobs. I spoke to this lady and within about 5-10 minutes she told me that she that morning had been considering suicide and opened up to all of these things and totally broke down. And literally 10 minutes later, just after having a few words and giving her a different perspective and buying her a cup of tea and giving her a cuddle, she just looked at me and she was like, I can't believe I met you. I never come into this cafe. I never come anywhere near this cafe because this is where all the British tourists come. And something brought me here today. And I definitely think it was you. So like I have loads and loads of moments like that, or meeting people in the street and just giving 10 minutes of time and a conversation that you don't realise that sometimes just a few words and a nice smile can quite life impacting for somebody that day. It could be the difference between, you know, they woke up that morning wanting to die and then that night they went home with a solution that they'd never thought of before. You know, those little impacts, and that was something I really, really wanted to do more of. And actually, certainly when the pandemic came around and I actually got the first time off in my life in about 20 years, I hadn't had more than a week off. Maybe a fortnight once in a blue moon, if I was lucky. When pandemic came around, I think that's when it really sort of kicked into being about thinking about what all this has meant or where this comes from or what I should be doing with it. I'd gone and getting some Reiki training when I was working in care, even did my level 2 and I loved it and I loved giving Reiki treatments. But then again, life takes over and you haven't time for it. And sort of listening to other people's stories, that's been a real revelation. And reaching out to people like you, looking for other people who have got this in common. And just seeing what that really means and where it takes us. And I would love to work with other people and learn from other people because I don't have the fear and I've got the time for it now. I'm in a very different position work-wise. I do a very different job now. The thoughts have been turning to, well, let's get back to that path that I've always been destined. I keep bobbing. It's got to be leading somewhere. Like I've always trusted the universe. I kind of let it take me wherever it's going to take me because that's what I've done my entire life. And it's looked after me pretty well, even through the hard times. You know, I always get everything I need. It always sort of comes out right in the end. And I've learned to trust that instinct and that magic and that flow and just go with it. But yeah, I think I would like to start getting, you know, this isn't a solo act. At some point, it would be nice to join in with other people and meet more people like you and share stories and hear other people's stories. I would like to maybe train and finish that sort of training that I started and do something like hypnotism work, facilitating that healing, facilitating that help for people. If I can make people feel that relaxed and that open and that safe.
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
I think you'd be excellent doing anything like that because it feels like, you know, you're set up for it and you're going to be very sensitive to it. So that's really wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing this with me. Really appreciate it. I look forward to hearing how you get on going forward.
Yeah, and let's see where the path takes us from here.
Exactly.
It's always looked after as well. I've always been quite trusting. That's one thing I have learned from a girl that had such trust issues and was so resistant. It's funny that when I didn't want all of it. It used to just flood all the time. And now that I really want it all, the harder I try, the harder I find it to do by will. So it is time to contact other people and start developing. Maybe that's been the message of this, is to actually share and come out and stop hiding in the shadows. And
yeah.
And hopefully find people to work with to share that experience. Maybe that's what the message of this, that's leading me down this path, is. So thank you for that opportunity, Jo. That's been great. It's been so unusual to talk about it so freely, and there is such a lot.
You know, I feel you have a job to do here, like we all do, but I feel you're very much wanted here and needed. And I feel certain that throughout your life, you've made a difference to people's lives. That's very clear. And you've still got lots more that you're going to offer. So I think you very much were meant to be here, and that you were very much wanted and loved here. So I think what you've done with your life has been a testament to that, and will continue to be so. So it's really lovely to meet you.
Thank you to our guest for sharing her story with us. It's difficult to hear how much she suffered as a child, and I'm so glad that she found her path in life and is now surrounded by people who love and appreciate her for who she is. The Anubis encounter is fascinating. Anubis is an ancient Egyptian god of the underworld who would guide and protect spirits of the dead on their way to the afterlife. It's thought that he is one of the most ancient gods. He is depicted as a black jackal or a black jackal-headed man. And as I said in the episode, it's likely that the jackal's link with the afterlife is associated, as these animals would prowl around the graveyards at night. He is also associated with the embalming process. Priest embalmers would wear a jackal mask and carry out their sacred work in his name. Incidentally, the mummification process would turn the body pitch black. In Egyptian mythology, Anubis was the original creator of mummification. He aided Isis to collect and embalm the pieces of her murdered husband Osiris, lord of the dead, fertility, resurrection, and vegetation, after Set had murdered him. This allowed Osiris to achieve rebirth. Anubis appears on Tumart as a protector, often shown overseeing the judgment of the deceased in the weighing of hearts. And he continues to be invoked as a powerful protector to this day. What was Anubis overseeing that night when our guest saw him appearing to observe a group of shadow beings? What was it within her that enabled her to connect to him in that moment? It seemed to her as if these people had been making their journey between this world and the next. And why was she able to observe this? There are many questions, and I'd love to hear from you if you've heard anything similar or you can think what it might have been related to. As our guest says, she feels as if she's always walked a line between the worlds, and her later encounter with the Hat Man felt familiar to her in some way. The Hat Man is a well-known archetype, sometimes associated with sleep paralysis, in the same way that the old hag syndrome was known historically. People all around the world have reported seeing this shadow figure wearing a wide-brimmed hat and either a long trench coat or a cloak. The figure will often fade away after a short time, and they are described as being blacker than black, the darkest of dark, even within the shadows of the night. The observer will often feel as if he is looking at them, assessing them in some way, and in many cases he's spotted in a doorway, a threshold, as we know, a liminal space. Some report him as having red glowing eyes, and in a number of cases, witnesses say they sense him feeding off their terror. Having said that, our guest's encounter seems to suggest that the terror aspect may not always arise, and there are others who are used to his presence. Here are some shares that appear on the Hat Man Project. This was set up in the early 2000s by Timothy M. Brown Jr., who as a child would see this figure enter the bedrooms of his grandmother and great-grandmother, who were also both aware of the Hat Man's ongoing presence. It wasn't until years later, when he heard shadow beings being talked about on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, that he realised it was a worldwide phenomena. He believes these encounters are on the rise and is collecting people's experiences. I will post the link on the show notes. Here's a couple that have been posted lately. I've encountered the Hat Man my entire life. Since I was around 8, I clearly remember the first time I saw him, standing by my bedroom door, wearing a long coat and a hat. I told my mum, but she dismissed the situation. I grew up in Puerto Rico, and he kept visiting me, just standing by my door, watching me. At one point, I stopped being afraid of him and treated the situation like it was a friend stopping by. I never talked about it to anyone for fear of being labelled crazy. Suddenly it stopped. I didn't see him anymore, and I haven't since. Fast forward around 10 years later, living in North Carolina, my daughter, 18 years old, told me that during a sleep paralysis, she saw a man with a coat and a hat staring at her. Every detail she gave me was the exact description of my visitor for many years in the past. I decided to Google it, looking for answers, meaning, or something explaining these encounters. To my surprise, I came across this page. I was not alone. We aren't crazy. The Hat Man is real. So this is interesting that he's hanging around in the doorway, and also that it seems to have come down through generations. It's also interesting that once she decided to stop being afraid, that's when he went away. So this is an interesting thing to do, and actually it's useful in life as well, because we can decide to change our mind about things. We can just decide to not be afraid anymore. And if we make a really strong intention about that, it's hugely powerful and nobody can break that. It's within us. So it's worth, you know, thinking about that. Here's another encounter that was handed in to the Hat Man Project. My Hat Man experience from 30 years ago just came rushing back to me last night. My husband came to bed and told me that earlier that day, on a hike with our 12-year-old son, our son said something weird. Our son told him that he woke up in the middle of the night and saw a man with a top hat with red eyes standing on the counter of his room. The man was also wearing what he thought was a trench coat. My husband decided to tell me about my son's experience right before bed. I was kind of freaking out because his experience matched mine and my brother's from 30 years ago. After discovering that we had all experienced the same thing, my son did some digging and found this website. I am glad to know that there are others that have experienced the same thing, and it's not some experience limited to us, because somehow that seems worse. These accounts seem to suggest that the Hat Man drops by on individuals, and possibly, as I say, through generations, but we just don't yet know why. Are they shapeshifters? Are they from another world, between the worlds? Are they evil, as many seem to suggest, or are they neutrally observing us for some unknown reason? Does our response to them make a difference? I did wonder if, under that hat, are there two jackal ears? Is he performing the same kind of role as Anubis in some way? Protecting? Overseeing? The Hat Man is clearly a being that remains in the shadows for now. If you have had an experience, I would love to hear from you, and if you haven't already submitted your encounter to the Hat Man Project, then please consider doing so. Thank you for listening to this episode. Whenever I feel I'm in need of protection, I call upon my ancestors and particular saints, gods and goddesses that I like to work with. A good method of protection is to imagine a bright neon blue light around you and around the perimeter of your home. Be direct and unwavering in your intention that you are protected. Perhaps rather than feeling unnerved by hearing stories like this, Maybe we can seek comfort in the fact that we are expanding our perception of what this world is and our place within it. That these mysteries that demand our attention at this time may lead us to a place of understanding and give rise to a greater and healthier perspective about what is possible in this world. We let go of old limitations. We move past them, leaving the heaviness of the old way of being behind. I send my love to you at this time in the world, and I invite you to always remain curious.